This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio. Now it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm today's host, Joe Clement. Denise Morris is our producer. And that was Blind Boy Paxton playing our theme song, Mole on the Ground. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning with interviews, reviews, music, and commentary from a radically democratic, socialist, feminist perspective to lift your spirits, raise your consciousness, and blow your mind, all in the service of the liberation of all people and the earth from capitalism, racism, and patriarchy. Today's show starts out with Bill Resnick and Sammy Roth, an environmental journalist. They discuss a study commissioned by the City of Los Angeles titled LA 100% that found, to the investigators' great surprise, that LA could transition to almost 100% renewables by 2030. Jan Hawken talks again with Emmeline Friedman, this time about QAnon as a political and cultural phenomenon. They take up the ways the platform engages a range of anxieties and desires among platform supporters and users, and what it may signal about our current political crises. From the archives, we hear Denise Morris review the 2014 film Pride, a historical comedy drama about lesbians and gays support the minors, LGSM. Led by members of the Communist Party of Britain, LGSM were lesbians and gays who supported the National Union of Mine Workers during the year-long strike of 1984 to 85 under Margaret Thatcher. The theme of solidarity really shines through on this one. You can listen to past episodes of The Old Mole on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/oldmole. If you have comments, questions, suggestions, or an interest in contributing, our email is oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Sammy Roth on LA 100%.
Sammy Roth, welcome to KBOO.
Happy to be here, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Sammy Roth has been in climate journalism for the last 7.5 years, the last 2.5 years for the LA Times. He writes the Times Boiling Point weekly newspaper. It explores climate change, energy, and climate action. He's covered many of the great stories coming out of California's climate change efforts. Plus, he's examined the phenomenal growth of community energy in California in the last 10 years. When pursuant to state law, city and county governments have taken over more than 5 million electricity customers from California's investor-owned utilities, who, however, are now fighting for their lives and are trying to destroy community energy. He's most recently covered a stunning study commissioned by the L.A. City Council and its public utility in L.A., its Department of Water and Power, probably the most famous utility in the world from the movie Chinatown. The study finally found that L.A. could be 98% powered by renewable energy by 2030. That's less than 10 years from now, and it could be 100% renewable by 2035. Sammy Roth, tell us about LA 100, the 100% renewable energy study, why and how it was commissioned, its findings, and the way they did it to reach that finding. It really was a most careful study.
This is a really important and quite interesting study that was conducted for LADWP by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, or NREL, which is this federally funded research institute out of Colorado. And what NREL did was they used a supercomputer, the Eagle supercomputer, on their campus in Golden, Colorado. And over the course of like 4 years, they conducted more than 100 million simulations of the power grid in the city of Los Angeles. They had like 100 people working on this. They integrated all sorts of data on condition of the grid and how electricity demand was going to change and what weather conditions would look like as the planet warms up and how much potential there is for rooftop solar on homes. And they pulled all of this together and they ran all these simulations. They basically figured out, yes, in terms of technical feasibility, if you look at all of the clean energy options available for Los Angeles, Yeah, we can do 98% carbon-free electricity in the city by the year 2030 if we want to, and 100% by 2035, which is the target date that President Biden has set for the whole country to reach 100% clean energy. There are different options they looked at. They also looked at options for waiting until 2045 for 100%, which is what California's current legal mandate is. They found that the most expensive option, which would be doing this by 2035 without nuclear energy, which some folks don't like, it would cost $86 billion. They found that doing it by 2045 and including more things such as nuclear, you could do it for as low as $57 billion. A lot of it's going to depend on what individuals do as well and how successful city policy is getting people to put rooftop solar and batteries in their homes. They're replacing their gas heaters with electric heat pumps, getting electric cars. And of course, that's going to change demand on the power grid and change the scope of what you need to do. But overall, the main finding was you have a lot of options, but it's feasible to do this, and it's feasible to do it rather quickly.
Now, there's a few things that they studied that I thought were important. They also talked about zero carbon building and retrofitting all the old structures. And I think most importantly about energy conservation and use reduction. And they had to make estimates of how much could be saved in building out the whole system if, in fact, people used European levels, for example, of energy. If U.S. North Americans use less energy approaching European levels, the amount of building out of new energy and all of the rest would be cut by maybe a third or so, which is an enormous amount of effort, money. It seems to me that study is really unrivaled in its thoroughness.
I think that you will see more studies like this. This was a first-of-its-kind effort, so I think it is going to get somewhat easier to do this with practice and with investment in computing capability.
The question, Sammy, then becomes, what is LA and the Department of Water and Power, which is a public utility in LA, what's it doing with the study? Are they serious and taking steps to implement the 2030 pathway to 98%? Or is it like so many, many cities, just a well-illustrated plan that no one expects actually to be completed?
Well, I think a lot of this is just yet to be seen. The one significant thing that's happened since the study was published is that the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, came out and, based on the results, endorsed this 2035 target date that we should get to 100% clean energy by that year, came out with that in his State of the City speech. At the same time, it's been reported by us and by others that Garcetti is expected to take an ambassadorship job in the Biden administration and could be leaving the city quite soon. So I think there's pretty strong political support for this stuff here, but it's sort of yet to be seen where his successor will fall. I think the main thing that LADWP, and they told this to me, that they need to do is they need to start signing power purchase agreements, significant quantity of them and pretty big ones pretty quickly. There was a finding that LA has to build somewhere between 470 and 730 megawatts of solar, wind, and batteries every year for the next 25 years on average. And to put that into context, if you look at what the build-out has been for the last couple of years, that's potentially three times as much stuff as we've already been building. What they need to do is they need to start making those investments and start actually investing as well in new transmission lines to move this energy around. And, that was their comment to me, that they don't have a year to wait, that they need to start doing this stuff right now. So I'm waiting to see if that happens. And the other side of things, you look at rooftop solar policy and electric heat pumps and, gas use in buildings. And that's kind of an area as well where it's like, a little bit of waiting to see what happens. There are a bunch of cities in California, several dozen now, that have either banned gas in new buildings or significantly incentivized that new buildings should be all electric so that they can, run without burning natural gas and adding to emissions. And folks in LA have talked about that for a while, doing something like that. Garcetti has said he's open to some kind of clean buildings policy, but he did a survey of the city council a couple months ago, and of the 15 of them, I only had four who, came out explicitly in favor of that type of a, electric-only building policy. Not that that's the only way you could deal with emissions in buildings. There are other options out there, but it's not like the city has thus far pursued those either. So to answer your question, I do think they're serious about this, but it came out a couple months ago, and thus far I'm still waiting to see what happens next.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old World Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM. I'm talking to Sammy Roth. He's been a journalist doing the climate beat for the last 7.5 years at the LA Times. He writes the Boiling Point weekly newsletter on climate change, energy, climate action. There's considerable barriers. Clearly, you've talked about some of them. It's an enormous project. It will take money. My sense is that much of the stuff can be done by local contractors, in contrast to the industrial and utilities who are still angling across the United States to replicate their system using a humongously big grid. We need grids, but not continent spanning, not so high security, and not as expensive, not singularly designed pylons crossing rivers and Inca forests and the rest. It seems to me, though, that it can be done. Let's talk about the funding. $86 billion is a lot of money, but that stretches out over a number of years. On a yearly basis, it's not much. And in fact, it's not much when you compare it to the amount of money that Biden is ready to dedicate to highway improvement. Let's talk about a number of the barriers. First, the costs.
Yeah, I think that you're right that the $86 billion over this period of time at the high end is relatively manageable. I mean, what the NREL folks did was they compared it to the overall size of LA's economy. LA has $200 billion in annual economic output, and compare $86 billion over 15 or 25 years or whatever the timeline ends up being to a city with a $200 billion annual economy. It's a small fraction. The summation of the study was that this is not going to affect the city's economy on net in any meaningful manner. So that's important to keep in mind. Also important to keep in mind that, as you referred to, President Biden has a climate and infrastructure plan that's out there, and maybe that goes somewhere and maybe it doesn't. But long term, it seems pretty likely that there's going to be federal support here as well. That it's not just going to be on the backs of cities and states to fund this all on their own. One thing I do want to comment on, you made the point about how it would be better to do this all with smaller, locally energy installations rather than, big continent-spanning grids and big companies. The research that I've written about, there seems to be pretty universal agreement among folks who have really done, thorough, rigorous analysis of this, that you're going to need a combination of both of those things. Even though there is a technical potential to put rooftop solar on, every house in America and parking lot and carport and garage, that you could, in theory, get at least much of the nation's power that way. For a combination of economic reasons and technical reasons about the way the grid operates, that doesn't seem especially feasible. I wrote about a study a couple of months ago that was done by a firm called Vibrant Clean Energy that was commissioned by groups that are favorable towards rooftop and local solar development. And this study, it's quite optimistic. I mean, it has been cited a lot by folks as who want more local clean energy. And it found that if you had a big national build-out of distributed solar, they're saying rooftops and warehouses and local community installations, that you could save almost $500 billion overall on the cost of the clean energy transition by really going big on rooftop solar. At the same time, the overall number they found was that, you could get like 247 gigawatts of power from rooftop, but you would still need 1,500 gigawatts, six times that amount from big solar and wind farms. You're going to need a lot of transmission and big continent-spanning type infrastructure for that. So I just wanted to put that out there, that it's not quite so simple as saying, if you do one, you don't need the other. It seems like there's going to be a pretty strong need for both.
Yeah, I exaggerated the need for local power, locally generated, but people like Mark Jacobson talk about smallish utility scale plantations, let's say 50, 60, 80 miles from the point of use. LA could have wind turbines off the coast and also wind turbines and solar in the high desert, near Lancaster, which is now 100% small city.
And LA is getting a lot of its energy from those sources now. I mean, the city is contracting with solar farms that are in the northern desert part of the county and southern Kern County, and windmills that are out in the Tehachapi Pass that aren't too far from the city. I mean, they're definitely doing that. It's not like all of this stuff is far away. But at the same time, they're also, signing contracts for wind power in New Mexico, for instance.
Yeah. I think what I'm most concerned about is the investor-owned utilities and the bankers maintaining control of the energy system and profiting so handsomely from it, especially the underwriters and the people who hold the bonds and the rest of that apparatus. They impose huge rents on the U.S. economy, and they slow the pace of doing anything because they don't want to strand assets. It seems to me that it has to be the cities and states who control the pace of change. Yes, private sector, so-called, also though public, big plantations. It is necessary, especially for high population areas like New York or L.A. It requires some very big plants. I'm wondering about the investor-owned utilities. They're trying to stay alive in California, like PG&E, trying to force the state to pay the damages for the fires, and the state would have to partner with PG&E, one of the most negligent utilities that did everything to maintain their dividend, including not taking care of their lines, causing whatever it is, $30 or $40, $50 billion worth of damages and many deaths in California. I'm a little afraid that they're still alive and going to force and be in a position to force the state to partner with it. Is that a possibility?
The way things are now, I think that's very likely that PG&E will continue to play a significant role. I mean, a couple of points. One thing to keep in mind with community choice aggregation, which I have written a lot about, you know, a lot of the community choice aggregators have been quite successful so far in terms of scaling up clean energy. But something to keep in mind there is that PG&E and in Southern California, you know, you have Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric. They're still the companies that are owning and operating the electric grid. So even in, you know, Marin and Sonoma and parts of L.A. County and places that have launched these CCAs, they're still dependent on the big investor-owned utility actually delivering the energy to them and running the system that delivers the energy. So even if the entirety of California tomorrow were to go into the community choice model and the utilities were no longer in the business of buying and selling energy, the whole thing of clean electric grid would sort of be happening on the backs of their transmission systems and distribution systems. So for one, I think they're not going away for that reason. You know, another thing to keep in mind, and your point about the enormous problems that PG&E has caused is very well taken. So I you know, totally understand and hear from folks all the time who are incredibly frustrated that they still have to continue to deal with this company and their continuing mistakes. But, you know, it's interesting when you look at clean energy policy. I mean, PG&E stands to benefit, you know, significantly both from the transition and the other investor-owned utilities, both from the transition to clean energy, but especially from the investments that they'll be asked to make in the electric grid. We're right now, California is attempting to become more dependent on the electric grid as a society. We're talking about, you know, electrifying vehicles and transportation, which is going to add to electric demand. You know, we're talking about placing gas heaters and gas stoves with, you know, with electric heat pumps and induction stove, which is going to add demand on the electric grid. And, you know, there are arguments for and against, you know, being so reliant on the electric grid, but that's what California is attempting to do right now. And so for a company like PG&E or Southern California Edison, for instance, they're seeing that as a big opportunity because that's going to allow them to invest all sorts of money in the expansion and maintenance of the grid, and they get guaranteed returns on that. You know, the ratepayers have to pay their profit margins when they make those investments. It's a little bit of a two-sided coin because on the one hand, yeah, there's the argument that you're making of why should this transition be benefiting these big monopoly companies that we don't have a choice but to deal with? Can't we do this without them? You know, the other argument, I think, would be that so much of the obstacle and barrier to climate change action has been, you know, political resistance and economic resistance and, you know, entrenched players who are fighting against this stuff. And here we've got some entrenched players that have a pretty strong economic motivation to argue for it and to push it along. And you see that happening in practice, not always, but sometimes. They've certainly, you know, been fighting to reduce incentives for rooftop solar because that hurts their business model, and that's been an active fight with climate advocates in California right now. But at the same time, PG&E has been super favorable, or at least, you know, not resisted policies phase out gas service territory. You know, it's the gas company, but it's also the electric company. So if people are switching from gas to electric, it kind of still benefits, and it knows that. So I guess all I'm trying to say is that it's a complicated issue with a lot of different factors involved. But to answer your question, yeah, I kind of expect PG&E is not going anywhere.
My sense is that running it for the transmission system and doing the services, the computer billing and all the rest of it, and even much of the repair, they are a regulated utility now. If the California Public Utility Commission or the Public Utility Commissions in other states were to, in fact, crack down on them and, in fact, force them to do what they should be doing more quickly. In fact, some of the grid is already being managed by one of the state agencies. that they would be doing that work, but under far more supervision and according to more rigorous standards than they have now. And they wouldn't be making the policy then for the entire energy system. They would be playing a part in the entire effort, but not be on top of the heap. The question is how much power they're going to have. Somebody's going to have to do that work, whatever you call them. And they have some experience, and they've got a lot of good workers who will do it. You don't want to get rid of them. You want to force them to adapt to this new world.
Probably go back to what I said before, that I think the future is going to be a combination of things and not all one thing. I do think that big power companies, utilities, and independent producers are going to continue to be part of the scene. I think there's going to be a lot more local community type work on the power grid.
Yeah, I agree. The question is, what's the combination going to look like? Sammy Roth, you're a great reporter.
Thank you, Bill.
People want to get climate action and the major developments occurring on the climate and environmental front. The LA Times really does a good job, and Sammy Roth's newsletter at Boiling Point, it's a weekly newspaper. It's a must-see for people who are really interested in the climate.
I really appreciate you saying that, Bill. No, thank you. And if anyone wants to sign up for Boiling Point, they can do that by going to latimes.com/boilingpoint, and you just have to enter your email from there.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Georgia Buck is dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shonen in my bread. Georgia Buck is dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shonen in my bread.
I got into it because I loved it, and I loved the banjo, and I loved the sound. And then as I started to find the history, I went, wow, like, we had a huge piece of creating what has been set aside as this ethnically pure white thing. And I'm like, this is a problem, because the actual truth is actually way more interesting, and it's actually more indicative of who we are as a people. Like, people up here whose best interest it is to keep us divided, they don't want us to know this stuff. You know, because then it just makes us kind of, wait a minute, we outnumbered them. And this has been the conflict of the South since the very beginning, is keeping all the poor people, all the working class people at each other's throats through the invention of race. And that has been, you know, expressed through music. So I'm a musician, so it's the only way I can fight that is through knowing the history and doing it through music.
We'll hear more from Rhiannon Giddens later, who we just heard on PBS in 2019 talking about her music, about the contributions of African Americans to not just American music or even culture, but to the trajectory of American history. Before that, Bill Resnick was talking with Sammy Roth about LA 100%. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Even after the electoral defeat of Trump, QAnon remains an active platform for right-wing conspiracy theories and is widely perceived as a dangerous threat to democracy. Jan Hawken talks with Emmeline Friedman now about QAnon as a political and cultural phenomenon. They take up the ways the platform engages a range of anxieties and desires among platform supporters and users, and what it may signal about our current political crises. Friedman is a critical psychologist and social theorist who works at the intersection between psychology and digital technologies. She is author of Internet Addiction, A Critical Psychology of Users. Jan?
Welcome again to KABU, Emmeline Friedman.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you were on the Old Mole several months ago to talk about the film The Social Dilemma and how this documentary attempts to explain the way users are enlisted to participate in platforms such as Facebook. Well, today we're talking about a much smaller platform, 8chan or 8kun more recently, and the image board where QAnon circulates as a thread, one that is feeding conspiracy theories advanced by many Trump supporters. QAnon has now entered the mainstream lifeblood of the Republican Party. Critiques of QAnon have also entered the mainstream with documentaries and HBO series and political commentary expressing urgency around QAnon as a lethal threat to American democracy and a recruitment site for far-right politics and violence. Emmeline, you've written about internet technologies and platforms, written a book about the internet and social media users, and worked in campaigns to reclaim the internet for public interest and as part of the commons. So let's talk about your assessment of the QAnon phenomenon, starting with how it works from a technological perspective.
Sure. So without diminishing the hard truths that QAnon distill for us politically, it is really important to see it as a web platform business at its finest, really. So most social media sites make their money by selling ads. And to sell ads, of course, you need users. To get users, you need amazing content that excites people and draws them in. And of course, people stay on these platforms, not just to observe passively, but to participate. So this is how the combined power-profit motive works. And this is why we shouldn't be surprised that Q is not, in fact, a high-level government official like Steve Bannon or Michael Flynn. Even if these guys eventually took advantage of what was going on there, Q turned out to be the father-son platform owner and technical administrator duo.
But by way of identifiers, why the Q and why the Anon? What do those terms mean?
Yeah, so Q refers to a high-level government clearance, a security clearance. And basically the idea is that this guy who goes by Q, but mostly remains anonymous, is dropping, he does Q drops, so he drops little bits and little leaks of information that is meant to be read, interpreted as signs to a whole bunch of users kind of participating in this mystery, basically.
Is it like Create Your Own Adventure for adults?
Very much so. And one of the most interesting parts, I think, of this participation strategy implemented by the owner and administrator of this for-profit platform is that they really invite users to do their research and kind of solicit them as intelligent interpreters and people who are really in the know and able to read these signs. And they say, hey, we need your minds on this.
So then that's that whole refrain, do the research, that plays on you can't trust scientists or the government or official sources. You have to do your own research. So can you expand on that and how that participation becomes monetized?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously there's the keeping users on the platform for the purposes of being able to place ads. But then there's kind of an outer rung. So besides just the platform owners and administrators being able to monetize things through ads, there are also people who are kind of more obsessed with doing the Q research. And they are people who are basically already equipped to monetize web content. So influencer type people who are able to garner a following by spending a lot of their time creating almost like higher quality content that distills these Q drops initially. This is kind of like a service for more casual followers of Q. And the Q drops who may simply just be spreading this content. You know, not a lot of us are really creating quality content for the internet, but, you know, most people are doing some sort of sharing, transferring this more radical content onto other web platforms like Facebook.
How much weight would you give to that distinction between people who are consumed with this, and it is kind of their jobs, and they're making money off of it, or garnering some kind of followers, versus casual friends or followers who have a kind of resonance with its increasing right-wing forms?
I haven't done the platform analytics on this, but my sense is that inner circle of bakers, they're called, who bake the crumbs that Q drops, is relatively small. And then those casual users who might share or repost something is quite a bit larger. You know, you can see this in other metrics and things that people have studied. For example, the fact that most people polled about specific facets of the Q narrative don't actually know these in detail, mm-hmm. or don't necessarily agree with the finer points. But these are people who presumably a larger group of people who sort of just spread this stuff without necessarily reading it in detail or knowing
what it
means.
It's like so many religions. There are the very pious, devoted followers, and there are people who go to church on the holidays, you know, so.
Precisely. And so often, right, there's something really in it for the major devotees, and it's really their responsibility to sort of fan this stuff as far out as possible.
So these crumbs that are baked into some kind of a form crumb cake, I like to call them, you know, the narratives and that cohere and emerge and take hold. Can you just describe some of the central narratives that are, you know, part of what's called conspiracy theories or conspiracy narratives, and whether those have shifted over time as the Republican Party has either directly or indirectly embraced Q followers?
Yeah, so the basic conspiracy theory, and this comes from, this sort of has roots in Pizzagate, the idea that high-level Democrats are running a child sex ring in the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. So fanning out from that, it's sort of the idea that there is, in the political sphere, also, you know, in the media, there is a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles. They're all liberals, like I said, in the government and in the media, who are running this sex trafficking ring. And QAnon basically exists to position Donald Trump as the messianic figure who is appointed by the military to basically take over the federal government and bring all of these evildoers under control. So there were lots of references to the storm is coming, the storm being the moment when Donald Trump sort of reins everyone in. There are sealed indictments, right, that would come out and bring all these people
so
back under control.
Let's return to that in a few minutes and how to read that narrative as a political symptom of something of dynamics going on in this country. But I'd like to ask you about, maybe as a fellow psychologist, how much weight we would give to the failure of many of the Q prophecies to be fulfilled. You know, I'm reminded of the classic book by Leon Fessinger, When Prophecy Fails, who followed a group of believers who went to a hilltop ready for the world to end, and then it didn't happen. And then he followed the beliefs and made certain predictions, some of which were supported by the research, some of which have been criticized, about why people who have an investment in a belief system continue even in the face of the failure of its prophecies. How do you assess the fact that many of the prophecies, including that Trump was going to win, that he was going to return on March 6th, and of course there's an upcoming prediction that he'll return to office in August. What difference does it make from your reading of the responses of Q followers?
Yeah, so a big part of When Prophecy Fails is that a major determining factor in whether or not people will eschew the fact that a prophecy did fail is how much that belief system and its affordances really embedded itself in the person's life or identity. And so I think at this point, it's important to think about the fact that internet phenomena typically have a remarkable capacity to fizzle. And this is in very large part because the things that happen online don't always succeed in creating genuine community where relationships are sort of lasting beyond the event, or, you know, they sometimes don't make enough of a connection to people's lives.
Right, and
offline.
That they don't require as much of people. And that's a difference perhaps between the Tea Party movement that emerged after the 2008 financial crisis and had an enormous impact politically around the country in bringing a lot of right-wing Republicans into office. And it was basically similar as its focus on dismantling the federal government, anti-taxation, anti-federal government. You know, the Tea Party had chapters and groups where people met, and it required commitments and face-to-face encounters. So you're saying that one aspect of these internet communities is they can be fairly ephemeral and not terribly binding.
Precisely. And this is really where the rubber meets the road in terms of how the internet sort of influences our lives. You know, no matter how much time you're spending in your basement on a particular platform, one might even say that the real work of forging communities online is making that connection to the offline world. And this is simply something that doesn't happen if the only focus of the platform is sort of generating revenue through ads. You know, so Q really, I think, broke through to the extent that it did break through to the offline world. It did so in a way that was deeply attached to Trumpism.
And the storm on the Capitol. So they did have their storm.
Precisely.
And there's some, it entered material reality, but also I think there are different readings of those signs as well, and how organized it was, how much QAnon followers were behind that. But, you know, there also are differences in these right-wing groups that have flourished in Oregon, like the Three Percenters, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys. You know, they have different politics, but they share a kind of anti-federal government ideology that's part of the far right. Do you see that in the stories, the conspiracy stories of QAnon, or how much has the anti-federal government politics taken hold here?
I do think that anti-federal government is a sort of unifying theme. And realistically, you know, the storm on the Capitol was sort of this, as it was an attempted coup, and as there have been comparisons to, for example, the military coup going on in Myanmar right now, I think that the anti-federal government point is the one to emphasize. And so you see Q politicians like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who aren't really interested in getting anything done politically. They kind of just want to be around doing nothing as a sort of effort to dismantle the federal government.
So just in closing, perhaps one response to QAnon would be to get the federal government to do things in the public interest for everyday people. Do you want to say anything about that or other ways we might politically respond other than through our own kind of moral panic about it that can also kind of magnify it? Perhaps there's a risk of magnifying it beyond its actual reach.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. And I think this is a really important point that, you know, if you have this far right radicalization so centered on destruction without building anything new, that's a really wonderful messaging opportunity and action avenue for the left, basically, is for the left to be able to reclaim to some degree its sort of creative drive. And this especially pertains to, you know, whether or not there is any hope left in the capacities of the federal government to, you know, govern for the people in public interest in a real way.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point to stop on. that's where we need to organize. Thank you so much, Emmeline Friedman, for being with us today on The Ole Mole again, talking about QAnon. And we hope to have you on regularly to talk about internet possibilities and politics.
That sounds wonderful. It's great to be here.
I can strike it harder than any man can. When Polly had a small baby on her knee, grabbed a hammer in her left hand. Ain't no one as strong as me. This is hammer, kill John Henry. Won't kill me, won't kill me. This is hammer, killed your daddy. Throw it down and we'll be free.
That was Polly Ann's Hammer from Songs of Our Native Daughters, a very special album put together by Rhiannon Giddens and a few other banjo-playing superstars, Amethyst Kaya, Layla McCullough, Allison Russell. This is your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour, Joe Clement. I really like this song as a kind of feminist dialectical twist on the story of John Henry and his hyper-masculinist productivism. And really that concluding line about how this hammer killed John Henry, it won't kill me. This hammer killed your daddy, throw it down and we'll be free. It's really this negation of the negation of this capitalist machine that just drives us with these imperatives to produce and labor and use ourselves up and use the earth up. Before that, we heard Jan Hawken talking with Emmeline Friedman about QAnon as a cultural and political phenomenon. Later this week, on June 19th, is Juneteenth, a holiday that commemorates the triumph of enslaved Africans and their descendants over the slavery imposed on them by the United States and later Confederate States of American governments. Last year, in the midst of the George Floyd protests, Multnomah County declared Juneteenth to be an official holiday. Many have the day off. Also last summer, Black Lives Matter launched a petition to make Juneteenth a national holiday. On the petition, they write, "As we continue the fight for freedom and justice around the world, we're calling on our communities to recognize this day, June 19th, as a national holiday, a time to reflect, learn, and activate resources to empower the Black community. Unlike holidays recognizing pivotal moments in white history, like Thanksgiving Day, Juneteenth is not widely known or taught in schools. While some states recognize it as a state holiday, it is not a national holiday, where offices, banks, postal services, schools, and other services are closed to allow space for celebration. Join us in the movement to make Juneteenth a national holiday, a time for us to be seen and celebrated. Our story is America's story. Our history is American history. It's time for it to be treated as such. This 19th, Juneteenth, is our opportunity to experience the joy and rally together to fulfill the hopes and dreams of our ancestors as we work toward liberation. Our celebration of Black people belongs in the history books and on the calendar." We'll post a link to that Black Lives Matter petition to make Juneteenth a national holiday when the show's posted. Today's show will wrap up with some more music by Rhiannon Giddens that honors and observes the history surrounding and moving forward from Juneteenth. Before that, though, we're going to hear a review from the archives. Old Mole Denise Morris comments on vital themes of solidarity between alienated sections of the working class portrayed in the 1914 film Pride. You can find Pride at the local library. It starts out with Tom Becker introducing the piece.
It's the summer of 1984. Margaret Thatcher is in power and the National Union of Mine Workers is on strike, prompting a London-based group of gay and lesbian activists to raise money to support the strikers' families. Initially rebuffed by the union, the group identifies a tiny mining village in Wales and sets off to make their donation in person. As the strike drags on, the two groups discover that standing together makes for the strongest union of all.
In 2014, 30 years after the historic UK National Union of Mine Workers strike from 1984 to 1985, two films were released. Still the Enemy Within is a documentary directed by Owen Gower and narrated by surviving mine workers who participated in the strike. The mine workers were called the Enemy Within by Margaret Thatcher and a conservative government, quote, intent on free market reform of the nationalized industries, which included plans for the closure of most of Britain's remaining coal pits. The public perception of militancy on the part of the National Union of Mine Workers still persists more than 30 years later. In a 2014 article by Georgia Rose for Vice magazine, director Owen Gower was asked to talk about the film's title, Still the Enemy Within. Quote, Margaret Thatcher herself called the miners the Enemy Within, and 30 years later they still have that label. The argument that they are not crazy militants waging war on the government has still not been won. It's still a dominant narrative of the strike. The other side of it is that they are still proud to wear that label, and they still believe in fighting for a better world today. It's about saying that the miners' strike is not just a piece of history, it's still ongoing. Regarding the struggles of the 1980s and their echo in the current political situation today, Gower comments, quote, Thatcher's project was to roll back everything that came out of the 1945 consensus, public services, nationalized industries, and so on. The miners knew that if they lost, it would be more than their communities that would be destroyed. There would be a weakening of unions as well as privatizations across the board. And that is what we're seeing today. Wages and pensions are being cut, and the gap between the rich and poor is deepening. The film Pride is the narrative counterpart to Still the Enemy Within. Directed by Matthew Warchus from a screenplay by Stephen Beresford, Pride is inspired by the true story of a London-based group of gay and lesbian activists and their efforts to raise money to support striking mine worker families. The film has been well received and won several high-profile awards. Described as feel-good, uplifting, and a comedy whose, quote, laughs are as fierce as its politics, Pride indeed is the film that deserves to be seen. The music is good, the early 80s fashion is
real good,
and the struggle is epic. Pride picks up in the summer of 1984 with Margaret Thatcher in power and the National Union of Mine Workers on strike. Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners is born on the day of the 1984 Gay Pride March in London, as a group of activists decide to raise money to support the families of striking miners. Not all gay liberation activists are on board, unable to envision the value in supporting people who don't support them. But emerging leader Mark Ashton understands the power of solidarity in the face of a common enemy. As he passes collection buckets to somewhat indifferent marchers, Mark explains, quote, I want everyone to take a bucket and start rattling. This is for the miners. It's a show of solidarity. Who hates the miners? Thatcher. Who else? The police, the public, and the tabloid press. Sound familiar? The task of finding mining towns to support was difficult as the union feared association with deviants. At last, LGSM identifies a mining village in deepest Wales and set off in a minibus to make their donation in person. Solidarity is at the core of this film, rightly so, as not all mine workers went out on strike, and the strike was deemed illegal because a national vote was not conducted. Divide and conquer was in full force, and the police were deployed to intimidate mine workers and their families, resulting in violence and mass arrests, these the same police who harassed and brutalized queers in London. Margaret Thatcher claimed, quote, There is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families. In response, director Matthew Warchus counters, quote, Pride's main characters fervently believe in the opposite, in the power of unity. Mark Ashton, a real-life activist who also worked with the Communist Party of Great Britain, understood the greater good in unity, and in the film is portrayed as unapologetic for his gayness and dedicated to solidarity, quote, One community should give solidarity to another. It is really illogical to say, I'm gay, and I'm into defending the gay community, but I don't care about anything else. Again from director Matthew Warchus, quote, Both groups in the film, LGSM and the Welsh miners, are certainly politically minded, but it's their humanity that's so compelling. Pride engages the audience not in party politics or preachy agendas, but in much bigger concepts of generosity and compassion. The film humorously depicts the developing relationship between apparent opposites, who somehow overcome the obstacles between them. In a way, it's a classic romantic comedy, but the relationship isn't between individuals, but between two groups or communities, and they are driven not by romantic love, but by compassion. I think it reminds us of the idea of society, that there is, of course, such a thing after all. Pride released in 2014, 30 years after the devastating defeat of mine workers to Thatcher's United Kingdom, reminds us that victories do emerge from defeats. I'll end with a tiny note on music. In response to a damaging tabloid article accusing mine workers of collaborating with perverts, the LGSM organized the fundraiser Pits and Perverts, featuring synth-pop band Bronski Beat. The event was a huge success. Not a surprise that the Red Wedge Collective of musicians formed in the UK in 1985, attempting to engage young people with politics in general, and the politics of the Labour Party in particular, in the hope of ousting the Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher. The Iron Lady would remain in office through 1990. The anti-establishment, anti-authoritarian music of the late 70s and early 80s will always live large in my heart. I think Bronski Beat, No More War, is a nice way to end. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, today talking about the film Pride. No more war, please. No more destruction.
KBOO Portland.
Devils have come to take you far from me. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't run, 'cause I see down yonder the soldiers come. Mistress, oh mistress, I do see, and I'll stay right here till they come for me. Family I got left, they're all I hold dear. That trunk of gold is yours, my friend. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't lie, if they find that trunk of gold by your side. Mistress, oh mistress, that trunk of gold is what you got when my children you sold. Mistress, oh mistress, don't you cry. The price of staying here is too high. Mistress, oh mistress, I wish you well, but in leaving here, I'm leaving hell.
by Rhiannon Giddens from her Freedom Highway album. Juneteenth is later this week, and we just want to hold up this day as a remembrance of both the terrible crimes of white supremacist colonialism and chattel slavery and the enduring oppression of black people, indigenous people, and other people of color. But more importantly, to celebrate freedom, emancipation, liberation for all people, liberation from political and social oppression, liberation from economic oppression, in the same way that the fight by the working class for the recognition of the working class through Labor Day celebrations and holidays accompanied side by side the 8-hour day movement and the growing movement of unionism itself. Juneteenth is a day for encouraging us in the ongoing struggle for freedom. I'd like to thank our guests, Sammy Roth, talking with Bill Resnick about LA 100%, Emmeline Friedman, talking with Jan Hawken about the cultural and political origins and implications of the QAnon movement, and to Denise Morris for her review of Pride. You can find Pride at the local library, too. You can find The Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can email The Old Mole at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail with your comments, suggestions, or desire to contribute. Thank you, KBOO listeners, members, staff, and volunteers for keeping this vital institution alive. Thank you for those who were able to donate in the last drive. For The Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement.